Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents In Blood and Ashes, Curse Tablets and Binding Spells in Ancient Greece, by Jessica L. Lamond, narrated by Mary Helen Gallucci. Introduction: Magic and Curses in Ancient Greece. In 1805 CE, Edward Dodwell and the artist Simone Pomardi traveled across the Ottoman-controlled Greek mainland, producing a series of chronicles, watercolors, and drawings of landscapes dotted with classical ruins. In the captive Greek countryside, Dodwell saw the grandeur of a far nobler past. "I beheld the native soil of the great men whom I had so often admired, of the poets, historians, and orators whose works I had perused with delight, and to whom Europe has been indebted for so much of her high sentiment and her intellectual cultivation. I gazed upon the region which had produced so many artists of unrivaled excellence, whose works are still admired as the models of perfection and the standards of taste." Dodwell's work fueled the appetites of European Philhellenes and breathed new life into a classical revival eager to celebrate these models of perfection. Yet, while drawing an ancient tomb outside of Athens' city walls, Dodwell chanced upon two women whose actions struck him as quite removed from the intellectual cultivation of Greek antiquity. "While I was drawing the outside of this sepulchral chamber, two Turkish women arriving seemed much disconcerted at my presence. One of the women then placed herself on the outside for fear I should intrude, while the other entered. And after she had remained there about 10 minutes, they both went away together, warning me at my peril not to enter the cave. The Greek who was with me said he was certain that they had been performing magic ceremonies, as the cavern was haunted by the Moirai, or destinies. Nothing would have tempted him to enter. And when I was going in, he threw himself upon his knees, entreating me not to risk meeting the redoubted sisters, who he was confident were feasting on what the Turkish women had left for their repast. I found in the inner chamber a small feast, consisting of a cup of honey and white almonds, a cake on a little napkin, and a vase of aromatic herbs burning and exhaling an agreeable perfume. When I returned from the sepulchre, I found the Greek pale and trembling and crossing himself very frequently. When he saw that I had brought out the contents of the feast, he told me that he must quit my service, as he was confident that I should shortly experience some great misfortune for my impiety in destroying the hopes and happiness of the two women by removing the offerings they had made to the destinies in order to render them propitious to their conjugal speculations. I gave the cake to the ass, who had brought my drawing apparatus, and by whom it was devoured without any scruples. But, unfortunately, as we were returning home, this animal, with a perversity not unusual in his restive race, ran away braying and kicking till he broke my camera obscura in pieces. I collected the fragments as well as I could, while my Greek, who was quite sure that the accident was owing to my intrusion into the cave, triumphed in his predictions. The loss of his camera obscura notwithstanding, and in 1805 this was no small expense, Dodwell readily spurned the women's belief in what he termed magic ceremonies, along with the distress of his Greek assistant. Yet Dodwell would have been troubled to learn that the ancient Greeks, whose ruins he devoted his life to documenting, with their high sentiment and standards of taste, were quite accomplished at performing spells, curses, and secret gravesite rites of their own. In fact, throughout the classical period, Greeks from all walks of life trafficked in magic with some frequency. By the 1840s, just over a decade after Dodwell's death, scholars would come to grapple with the emergence of a number of so-called curse tablets from across the Mediterranean. Broadly defined, curse tablets are small, thin sheets of lead, inscribed with maledictions, spells, and prayers against rivals, lovers, wrongdoers, or otherwise threatening persons. Material remnants of ancient curse rituals. Over 2,000 such tablets are known today from antiquity. These objects were deposited in graves, faunic sanctuaries, wells, and other underground locales, sites that practitioners understood as conduits to the underworld. Curse writers could invoke the likes of Hermes, Hecate, Persephone, and Demeter, subterranean deities known for traversing the worlds of the living and the dead, hoping to harness these powers and bring them to bear against mortal opponents. Though the great majority of curse tablets were composed in Greek and Latin, curse practice was adopted in the late classical and Hellenistic periods by the communities with whom the Greeks came into contact, from Punic residents of Carthage to Oscan groups of southern Italy. The Romans later spread the technology well beyond the Mediterranean basin, facilitating, through army and empire, the adoption of curse-writing rituals across the frontier provinces. Investigating the development and dissemination of ritualized cursing across the Mediterranean, this book provides a history of curse practice, alongside that of binding spells, incantations, and other ritual phenomena, in Greek antiquity from circa 750 to 250 BCE. While such rituals may not accord with Dodwell's exalted view of Greek culture, they greatly expand our understanding of daily life in ancient communities and provide rare insights into how individuals were making sense of the world and coping with conflict, vulnerability, competition, anxiety, desire, and loss. Curse tablets in particular document persons who often slip through the cracks of traditional histories, enabling us to approach antiquity through a broader lens. Here are cooks, tavern keepers, garland weavers, helmsmen, and barbers. These objects enrich our view of the classical past, populating the Greek world with a more inclusive group of narratives than otherwise afforded by literary sources. Consider, for example, the following curse, which was inscribed on a lead tablet in Attica soon after 300 BCE. These were the years in which Athens was reeling from decades of war, shifting alliances, and the sieges of Alexander's successors. Historical narratives from this period have long been dominated by the clashes of Cassander and Demetrius Poliorcetes, Lachares's tyranny, and other vying armies and political factions. Yet this tablet unlocks a different sort of history, providing a new sense of what can be studied and known about this period. The text offers a glimpse of professional cooks on the eve of a trial, shedding light on a little-known subculture within the early Hellenistic city. Tablet 1.1, Kerbera forthcoming. Athens. Provenance unknown, probably from a grave. End of 4th or early 3rd century BCE. Athens National Archaeological Museum. I bind down Theogenes, his tongue and soul and the speech that he is planning. And I bind down the hands of Poreas the cook, and his feet and tongue and soul and the speech he is planning. And I bind down the wife of Poreas, her tongue and soul. And I bind down Kerkion the cook and Docimos the cook, their tongue and soul and speech that they are planning. I bind down Cineas, his tongue and soul and speech that he is planning with Theogenes. And I bind down Pericles, his tongue and soul and the proofs that he gives as evidence for Theogenes. And I bind down Soothes, his tongue and soul and the speech that he is planning, and his feet and hands, eyes and mouth. And I bind down the tongue of Lamprias, and his soul and the speech that he is planning, his hands, feet, eyes, and mouth. All of these persons I bind down, I make disappear, I bury, I nail down. If in court or before the arbitrator they make any counterclaim, let them seem to be of no account, neither in word nor in deed. The primary target of this curse was a man named Theogenes, who, ahead of a trial in the Attic law courts, was bound down, together with his co-speakers, witnesses, and wider legal support network. The looming lawsuit seems to have been occasioned by a conflict between cooks, Magyaroi. The mention of an arbitrator suggests that a final chance at arbitration remained, but the cursing of speeches indicates that both parties expected the dispute to advance to trial and were actively preparing for that outcome. During the anxiety-ridden lead-up to trials, as evidence was gathered, witness testimony planned, and preliminary hearings attended, Athenians with resources might hire a speechwriter, seeking every possible advantage in the judicial process. This habit is well studied. What is less well known is that they might also seek supernatural assistance, as someone did here, by performing a binding curse against opposing litigants. Indeed, many of the oldest Greek curse tablets were occasioned by conflicts in the law courts. For the ritual's first 200 years, these objects were very often deployed in contexts of litigation. Several individuals cited in Tablet 1.1 seemingly refer to real, historic chefs known from later Attic comedy, which could satirize cooks and cooking schools. The ancient equivalent of the celebrity chef was something of a stock character in early Hellenistic comedy, caricatured as cheeky, thrifty, boastful, and highly competitive. The professional chef, or Magyaros, worked with a train of pupils and underlings, and could hold the groups for whom he cooked in awe. Suthes, preparing for a grand dinner in a play by Pasidippus, was likened to a brilliant, terrifying general entering battle. Lamprias, the protege of another famous Magyaros, was singled out in an early 3rd century drama by Euphron for perfecting the recipe for black broth soup. And in Lucian's day, Piraeus was still remembered in Athens as a renowned chef. Read alongside Middle and New Comedy, this curse tablet provides access to the robust, competitive, and sometimes conflicting networks within which professional cooks could operate in ancient Athens. After this malediction was inscribed, the tablet was folded and pierced 5 times with a nail. The nailing ritually echoed the binding or restraint of the named individuals. All of these persons I bind down, I make disappear, I bury, I nail down. What happened to the tablet, its user hoped, would befall the targets themselves. Next, the inscribed nailed tablet would have been deposited underground, probably in a conveniently sited tomb, though in this case the object's provenance was not recorded. Possibly the pouring of libations, the recitation of the malediction or related spells, and other graveside rites would have attended the tablet's burial. Recent finds from Himera's Bonfonello necropolis suggest that some curse tablets were buried during graveside funerary banquets, along with the consumption or libation of aromatic wine, or together with the pulverization of potions that might include bark, roots, and other organic materials. On the whole, curse tablets carried a variety of inscribed texts and were seemingly composed by both ritual professionals, figures like the so-called sorcerer, Chois, seer, Mandis, collecting priest, Ahirtes, and practitioner of magia, Magos, all of whom might claim expertise in the crafting of spells and curses, and, once the ritual had been popularized, by amateur practitioners. There was little homogeneity across or within these groups, and the ritual objects created by these individuals document a range of literacies and written competencies. Some practitioners employed punctuation and neat margins to structure their texts, which unfold in clear, confident hands. Other texts are sloppily inscribed and rife with misspellings. Distilling information about these ritual freelancers proves difficult, not only because of the sparseness of our sources, but also on account of their biased nature. These practitioners are described primarily by their business rivals and opponents, such as physicians and philosopher intellectuals. Plato, for example, envisioned penalties for ancient curse casters that differed according to their status. Death could be pronounced for the ritual professional, he writes, while the courts could exercise discretion in the case of amateurs. Already by the 5th century, the words magos and agiotes were used synonymously with terms meaning quack and charlatan. Nonetheless, it seems clear that many of these individuals would have identified as religious practitioners in possession of specialized knowledge or expertise in various types of rites, whether pertaining to incantations, sacrifices, often distinct from the standard animal sacrifice, libations, purifications, divination, pharmaca, drugs, and/or spells, dream interpretation, funerary rituals, or foreign and intention-based mystery cults. Not a few of these figures would have been itinerant, like many other practitioners during the 5th and 4th centuries, including rhetoricians, artists, doctors, and craftsmen. Tied to the sale of ritual goods and services, wandering priests and seers could promise those wishing to harm an enemy to hurt them, just or unjust alike, at little expense, by certain bringings against and bindings down, persuading the gods, as they say, to do their bidding. This passage contains one of very few links connecting katadismoi, which could here refer to both binding spells and inscribed curse tablets, to living, breathing entrepreneurs in classical Athens, and shed some light, however dim, on the mechanisms by which incantations and curse-writing rituals could spread within Greek communities. Able to channel and persuade the gods with their specialized knowledge, these agents were well-established fixtures of the ancient city. For individuals and households, they fueled a popular demand for ritual intervention and assistance in any number of circumstances. Such specialists played an important role in early Greek curse practice and help account for the ritual koina that spread across the Mediterranean by the 4th century BCE. Curse effigies. Conceptually similar to the curse tablet was the curse effigy, Rahipupa, formerly the voodoo doll, another material manifestation of curse rituals that physically represented the targeted individuals. Curse effigies also sought to control, incapacitate, harm, or otherwise influence targeted persons, from legal opponents to love interests. No fewer than 133 curse effigies are known from classical antiquity, of which some 50 were made of lead. Effigies were also fashioned from bronze, clay, flour, wool, and wood, and literary and epigraphic texts make clear that the ritual use of wax dolls was especially common in the ancient Greek world. In the 5th century BCE, a fragment of Sophocles' Root Cutters describes the melting of such a doll with fire, while in the early 4th century, Plato refers to molded wax figurines placed at doors, crossroads, and the tombs of ancestors, as well as the unease felt by passers-by upon viewing these objects. In later poetry, Theocritus's Simetha prays that Delphus, now a distant lover, melt with love for her just as she melts a wax effigy. Just as I melt this wax doll with the help of the goddess, so too may Delphus of Mindos at once be melted by love. Unlike lead figurines, wax effigies seldom preserve in the archaeological record, though some were certainly used in combination with inscribed lead tablets in Athenian curse rituals, as were effigies made of wood and clay. By the late 5th and 4th centuries BCE, curse effigies were deposited in contexts similar to those of curse tablets, with graves the most common sites of burial. Also, like inscribed tablets, curse effigies were manipulated and mutilated in ways meant to reciprocally bind, restrain, or damage the signified persons. The figurines were often twisted, nailed, or shackled before deposition. Several were punched through with nails, and at least one effigy was beheaded. The verbal idiom of binding was visually conveyed through the twisting back of the arms or head, the bending back of legs, and the application of fetters around the neck, wrists, or ankles. Many of these features are evident in a decapitated lead effigy from Athens, in addition to a cast lead effigy from the Cycladic island of Paros. Effigy 1.2, Lamont, 2021d. 10.2 centimeters tall, 3.1 centimeters from shoulder to shoulder. Visti Necropolis Perikia, roof tile grave. Early 4th century BCE. Paros Archaeological Museum, B, 5984. Inscribed text. Text runs down the back of left leg. Theophrastus. Text runs down back from left shoulder blade to top of buttocks. Theophrastus. Text on back of head. Omega Sigma. Os. Buried during the 4th century BCE in a small tile grave, likely that of a child, this lead effigy was pierced with 7 iron nails, one through the mouth, one through each eye, 3 through the skull, and 1 through the anus. The figurine's arms were twisted behind the back. The hands were pinched together, as though bound at the wrists. A lead shackle restrained the neck, further signaling the subjugation and restraint of the target's person. The effigy's backside carries 3 inscriptions naming the curse's target, a man called Theophrastus. The incision, repeated nailing, and shackling of the effigy aimed to ritually bind and incapacitate Theophrastus, and to assert control over him. The object's deposition in a grave was probably meant to deliver the effigy to the powers of the underworld, who would accordingly bring the curse against Theophrastus to pass. The elaborate and costly manufacturing process required a high degree of technical expertise, which suggests that this effigy was produced by a professional ritual practitioner. In 1.2, the inscribed name Theophrastus signals that the lead figurine sought to represent that man specifically. Other 5th and 4th century effigies carry multiple inscribed names, indicating that the figurine did not necessarily represent a single victim, so much as the ritualized act of binding one's enemies. And just as some curse effigies were inscribed with text, curse tablets could also carry images. This is now attested in an early curse tablet from Sicilian Himera, recovered in a grave of early 5th century date. Interpreted as an erotic attraction curse, the tablet contains a sketch of a recumbent woman named Echecratia, beside a man named Menecrates, who cast the spell to subdue Echecratia and to draw her to him. As with curse tablets, what befell the effigy was meant to befall the victims themselves, a popular form of sympathetic magic. In some regions, curse tablets and effigies were employed in tandem, and their early use appears to have developed in parallel. In Athens, for example, which has yielded an abundance of curse assemblages in secure archaeological contexts, no lead effigies are known to predate Attic curse tablets. Rather, effigies appear alongside tablets in some of the oldest Athenian curse assemblages, serving the same function materially or visually as the inscribed tablets did textually. In fact, Attic practitioners could combine curse tablets and effigies in the same binding ritual, and the two modes of cursing otherwise overlap in various ways. Some lead effigies from graves of the Kerameikos were enclosed in coffin-like lead containers that resembled curse tablets, for example. Another Attic practitioner fashioned a simple effigy out of a flattened piece of lead, and then inscribed it with a curse text as though it were a tablet. It is clear that in Athens, effigies were used in curse-writing rituals to bind enemies by around 400 BCE, roughly the time in which the earliest Attic curse tablets emerge. Still other communities of practice, like those on the Cycladic islands of Paros, Chaos, and Thelos, may have preferred the use of effigies over tablets when casting curses, as these sites to date have yielded exclusively Paros, Chaos, or primarily Thelos, curse effigies from the 4th century BCE on. Yet, in the city that has yielded the oldest Greek curse tablets to date, Salinas in southwest Sicily, curse effigies are largely unknown. Early Sicilian curse writing rituals seem to have been performed without the fashioning of effigies, and curse tablets assert a written self-awareness. Thus, although effigies were certainly used in Greek rituals prior to the advent of curse practice, the Foundation Oath of Cyrene, for example, documents the melting down of wax effigies in a ceremony that may date back to the 7th century BCE. It is not evident that such effigies were used to restrain or incapacitate the actions, speech, or tongues of opponents, and were not buried in sites associated with the underworld. Furthermore, the handful of twisted bronze effigies from Arcadia that were once attributed on stylistic grounds to the Archaic period almost certainly date from no earlier than the 4th century BCE on the basis of manufacture techniques and then unavailable comparanda recovered in the past 100 years. As small inscribed bronzes found outside of archaeological contexts, they lend no clarity to the question of the antecedents of inscribed curse tablets. Curse writing rituals only emerge once literacy has become more widespread in the early Greek world, and many of the oldest curse tablets were occasioned by conflict in the law courts, institutions that were themselves evolving alongside the growing use of writing, and that were assuming a more prominent role in the adjudication of conflicts in late archaic Polaeus. In broad strokes, 1.1 and 1.2 demonstrate how curse tablets and effigies could work in practice, shedding valuable light on conflict, competition, legal institutions, onomastics, ritual, and writing habits in ancient Greek communities. These objects offer rare insights into the public and private lives of individuals from around 500 BCE through late antiquity and beyond, illuminating the interplay of ritual and conflict management strategies among citizens and the enslaved, men and women, pagans and Christians, providing the first historical study of curse practice in the ancient Greek world. This book uses such objects to open new areas of research within the fields of Greek social and cultural history, unveiling the lives, beliefs, and practices of individuals and groups that have often been hidden from view. The project documents the cultural pressures that drove private cursing, situations of anxiety, uncertainty, antagonism, and vulnerability. And, as importantly, it reveals the ways in which individuals work to negotiate with the world, here in the literal sense, underground, conjuring the powers of the underworld and calling upon the dead to aid and restrain the living. That said, it can still be a challenge to extract these histories, especially as curse tablets and effigies regularly name the individuals being cursed, but only rarely the agents who inscribed or commissioned the objects. This can make it difficult to discern who in the ancient world deployed these rites. Yet, since there must have been considerable interaction between the curse writer and the targets of the curse in order for conflict to develop, in most cases we can make educated, if uncertain, inferences about the curse writers themselves. In many instances, it is probably safe to assume, as David Jordan wrote, that when a man is cursed, it is by social, political, and economic peers. Many early curse tablets document conflicts between persons of considerable means and resources, including wealthy and prominent citizens who sponsored liturgies, served as financial guarantors, or funded choruses in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE. In nearly all regions, evidence undermines the once popular notion that curse practice was the last resort of the poor, the destitute, the rabble. Curse rich.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?